friends first, may I request that we have no more questions handed in. I have enough questions to run me for the next 30 days if we could continue this discussion. My apologies to all of you who have given me questions that we cannot get to, but it is an utter impossibility to deal with all of them, and yet I am grateful for every one of them. I do note this, and I'd like to make this request of us, that we give a little better attention to what we're actually discussing here. And I'm amazed at the many, many questions that I had handed me today with reference to discussions on yesterday and the day before, which evidence the fact that we're simply, some of us at least, either not making ourselves clear or else some of the rest of us are not understanding what's being said. And so let's be very careful along that line. I thought in connection with that of a little amusing incident that I heard related at a table a while back in a place where I was conducting a meeting. One of our sisters, a school teacher, was telling of some of her experiences in an elementary school that she was teaching in that community. One of her pupils, a little colored miss, about 7 or 8 years old, came up to her and said, "Miss Mary, how you spell day?" She says, "D-A-Y." She went back to her seat, and a moment or two, she's back again. She said, "Miss Mary, would you tell me how you spell day?" She says, "D-A-Y." She went back to her seat, and just a few moments, here she was again, tugging at the teacher's sleeve. "Would you please tell me how to spell day?" She says, "D-A-Y." Well, she said, "Rasmus back there says you spell it T-H-E-Y." So, sometimes we just simply don't catch what is being said. So that's the situation with the questions, and I want us now to give close attention to it. Now, the first one here will introduce to us what I think is the theme that most of us are interested in. Now, I have questions involving many, many subjects, but it seems to me that in view of the fact that this is a lectureship devoted to the study and consideration of liberalism, that ought to be the chief theme for these afternoon forums. And so I'm going to try to keep it as much as I can on that subject this afternoon. Now, here is a statement. Should the church sponsor such events as was put on last Easter at Daytona Beach, where members of the church entertain with rock and roll bands? Then they'd stop and testify for the Lord, and then play and sing more rock and roll music. Well, to me, it's incredible, absolutely incredible, that those who affect to be members of the church would participate in any such thing. But it's just as incredible to me that a situation would have been conducted as was conducted and with which we dealt in the forum last year in Dallas, when the drummer of a similar group got up and looked over a crowd of young people and said, "This is the biggest bunch of Jesus freaks I ever saw in my life." Well, to me, that's as shocking as is this instance right here. It evidences the fact that a lot of our folks are no longer satisfied with the phraseology and the practices that have formerly characterized us. That's one of the big reasons, friends, why I am so opposed to the use of the modern speech translations that are now being distributed throughout the land. Amen. They deal with a phraseology that's first, in the first place, not characteristic of us, not familiar to the average person, and which I think tends to cause disrespect for the sacred writings. But we'll have more of that to say in just a few moments, and doubtless you'll wish to say something about it too. Now, here is another quotation that I wish to introduce at this time. At a recent lectureship, and certainly was not this one, this statement was made, and it's a direct quotation from the tape. Quote, "In the 1970s, revivalists will cross denominational lines so that there will be more unity and more mutual feeling of brotherhood and fellowship with others who are also concerned about renewal in another body than there will be with the traditionalists in the body of which you are a part." He defined revivalists, and that's the end of the quotation. Here's the comment. He defined revivalists as those seeking to restore the church. Well, that would be us, of course. Now, here is a statement that says frankly that not far distant, there will be a crossing on the part of us all of denominational lines and participation in such events along with others who are genuinely concerned about unity. I read a while back a book, the title of which is The Fellowship of Believers, in which, imagine now, a rectangle, and see in the rectangle the word fellowship. See from that lines running in several directions with a circle at the end of each, and then inside each circle, one of the denominational bodies, and also including the Church of Christ. Now here was the view, that we can never find fellowship in our respective bodies. Therefore, what we all ought to be willing to do is to come down these paths away from our denominational positions and all enjoy fellowship in the area of fellowship. Then if we want to, when we get ready, we can all go back to our different denominational pens. Now, that is nothing more than the old mourner's bent system of religion that was practiced in years past added to the union meeting concept. That's what that amounts to. And that's exactly what we're seeing in many places today. And so far as I'm concerned, I'm quite opposed to it. Now let's introduce another one here. If neighboring congregations uses a man in a meeting that teaches you can be in the kingdom without being baptized and various other questionable teachings, are the faithful congregations in the area obligated to make some type of formal public action toward the congregation endorsing such a man? I think they are. I think they ought to tell their members and warn them with reference to the dangers involved in such a situation. Now, I know it's said that you can't, that one congregation can't withdraw from another congregation. Well, withdrawal is on an individual basis, that's right. But if you as an individual and a member of this faithful congregation and every other member of that faithful congregation practices what he ought to with reference to the other congregation, when you get through, it involves the whole of it, if not one of them. And so it seems to me that that's the way it should be done, and that's what ought to be done. Now, another two or three others here we'll introduce, and then we'll throw it open to you. Doesn't watered-down preaching arise from watered-down translations? Well, I would say yes in answer to that. Then another one here. Is the word fellowship always used as a noun and never as a verb in the New Testament? Is it something we may extend or withdraw? Now, the verb form of the word translated fellowship is used several times in the New Testament, one of which is found in 1 Peter 5:22, where it says, "Be not a partaker of other men's sins." And the word partaker there is from the same Greek word, at least the same root from which the word fellowship comes. And that's exactly what's involved in the word fellowship, joint participation. And you simply cannot participate with false teaching. Then I have another question which you can't find, but I want to introduce it right at this point in that connection, and that's this. What about the view that's being advocated by some of the brethren who oppose the orphan homes that you can have partial fellowship? Now, they have a little controversy going on among them with reference to degree of fellowship that might participate, they might participate in with us, but not all of the way. So this surely now introduces enough material that we can all find something about which to comment if we're interested. Now, who has the first comment with reference to any of these matters thus far introduced? And again, may I ask for your assistance in identifying the person who wishes to speak, because I can't see the whole audience at any one time. All right, sir.
Brother Wood, with regard to the question there, the preacher coming in, teaching these ballparkers what other congregations could do, would it be prudent for a congregation to make a public announcement, perhaps even in the newspaper, that they are not participating in this?
I feel that such would be. And thus to inform the neighborhood that the churches of Christ that are faithful in the community do not endorse or support such teaching. And certainly, announcements ought to be made from the pulpits of faithful congregations to warn the members of such, and if the members persisted in attending such, they ought to be visited and warned by the elders, and if they persisted in it, withdrawn from. We ought not to support false doctrine. Do you agree or disagree?
Agree.
All right, who next? on any of these matters? I'm sorry, I don't see you. All right, sir.
To make it a little more clear about the version, do you intend that the King James is the one, or could we use something?
Well, in answer to that, I would say that I believe the American Standard Translation to be, on the whole, more nearly a reflection of the original Greek text than any other commonly or widely used translation today. It is almost a literal rendering of the Greek text. In fact, when it first appeared, some of the criticisms that were offered against the American Standard Translation was that it was too literal. But if one wishes to ascertain what the Greek text really says reflected in our vernacular, he'll find it in the American Standard Translation more nearly than any other common translation. Now, I think that the Living Oracles constitutes, on the whole, the best translation that's ever been published, but it's not widely known. And when I speak of a commonly used translation, I mean the American Standard. Yes, sir.
Would you include also the New American Standard, which is somewhat of a revision of it?
Well, I'm sorry that I cannot comment on that because I am simply not familiar with it enough to do so. I know it exists, but I have made no use of it because I haven't felt that there was any need to. In the first place, I'd like to say this. It is a mistake for any careful student to use a multiplicity of translations in his study if he ever expects to quote the scriptures, because the first thing you know, he can't quote any of them correctly. What he's doing is quoting a conglomeration of all of them. And I submit, friends, that there's a time when it's very effective to be able to quote correctly a translation that's familiar to the people you're quoting it to.
Amen.
Do you agree, Brother Nichols, on that?
Agree.
Yes.
Amen.
Now, some of these modern speech translations are getting way on out, a long ways up. All right.
What about a teacher using American...
Stand up so they can all hear you.
What about the teacher using the American Standard Version where the class has the King James Version?
Well, in a sense, that's confusing. What I would do in a case like that is if I wished to quote from the other, I'd tell them that that's what I was using. But now... I'm fully aware of all of the arguments that are made with reference to the archaic and obsolete terms in the King James translation. I know that. But I still believe that a person can take a 25-cent King James New Testament that he bought at Woolworths 15 years ago, and you could buy them for that price, and learn all that God expects you to know in order to go to heaven by it. And when I hear some of my brethren reflecting upon that as if it were so outmoded and outdated that you ought not to fool with it, it gets under my skin. All right, next. Yes, sir.
We have reached a stage in the churches of Christ where we're either going to do something about this that's going to be effective, or we're not. These fellows, such as Blank, Brother Blank, Brother Blank, Brother Blank, that's not going to get it done. We're going to have to begin to name those men and say what they say, exactly what they're saying, and attribute it to them. And instead of just going ahead and accepting them all into our pulpits as though everything was all right, they've got to be marked and withdrawn from, as the Bible teaches us to do. Now, it seems to me that there are two or three things. Number one, as an illustration, we have a man in California by the name of Brother Blaine. You know him well. And he knows him well. All right, this man has caused more division and more confusion within a 150-mile radius of San Francisco than any man, to the extent that the churches in that area absolutely refuse to have any fellowship with him. And he is one of the most popular speakers on the lectureships, And in the churches, they just fall head over heels to bring them into their pulpit to hold the gospel meetings. Even held one of the biggest churches in Nashville just about 2 or 3 months ago. Brethren, if we're not going to mock those men and we fall on them, we might as well go out of business.
Amen.
All right, second thing. What about those congregations that bring those men in? Are we going to go ahead and have fellowship with them also? I'm saying that the time is here to lay the axe at the root of the tree.
Thank you, Brother Rice, and I might just say this, that I have read the first three chapters of the Galley Proofs of his Volume 3, and he lays the axe at the root, I'm here to tell you.
Brother Wood.
One other point now, before you get up, hold your point there just for a moment. I was amused at one statement that he made, in which he discussed the difficulty, which we all concede, to inherit in determining exactly what the word liberal is. So he decided the best thing to do is just to stop. He says we don't know exactly what to do from the standpoint of the New Testament to do with a liberal. But we know exactly what to do with a heretic. So he said, let's just call him a heretic, and the Bible tells us what to do with him. That reminded me of the doctor many years ago that didn't know how to treat a specific condition that a lady had, but he said he knew how what to do about it if it's fits, so he just threw her into fits, and then he could treat and cure that. So I think that Brother Rice has the right idea on this heresy business, because that's exactly what I regard it as. Now, with reference to this identification, there are two or three aspects of that. I find that a good many of my brethren are perfectly willing for them to be identified if I do the identifying. I have them to come to me on this campus, and they've been doing it for 20 years, and say, Brother Woods, we are behind you. We'll back you up in the exposures of these matters. And they back me up about 6 or 10 or 15 seats out there and never say one word when I get up here. Not one. Now, I have been bearing the brunt of these things for many years, as you well know. And I'm not about to quit. But I do feel like that Brother Rice and I are not the only ones that ought to do the naming. Now, how many of you fellows are naming them in your bulletins? Now, you may not conduct the forum, you may not write acts at the root, but then you do preach for congregations and so on. All right, next.
That brother over there, Brother Woods, that was out of my
room. Well,
I'm just going to make...
Yes, I'm sorry, I apologize.
Rice, his room is next to mine over here in the motel, and we keep hearing chopping at night. I don't know what...
Trouble, and I live right up the street from it.
Yes, sir. All right.
Brother Wood, I remember back in 1951 at the famous Florida Christian College lecture, otherwise known as the infamous, that there was an article written, unsigned, and sent to the Gospel Advocate, exposing those lectures. I remember also, it went along for several months. I finally wrote an open letter to my brother and signed it, because I thought somebody else ought to do the job, as bigger than I am and more important. They said down there that I had no influence. I didn't. I don't claim one. But I want to get to the point that you made just now. A very fine gospel preacher, Pastor Mark, came to me and he said, Brother Walker, I want you to know I appreciate the stand that you have taken, the work that you have done, but don't quote.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Don't quote. Yes, sir. I believe it's time for brethren to say, quote me, and I'll back it up. I believe that. Now, I want to say one thing more. There have been some rumors flying around about one of our preachers in Bowling Green. And as long as those are rumors,
I can't do anything about it. But if they bring some documented evidence, then I'm ready to go to work.
Amen.
But now, give me something I can quote with an angel sign to me.
Amen.
And if you don't do it, keep your mouth shut.
Amen.
I think that there are a few other things to be considered in this, and I don't think we're dealing with the issue as we ought to here. In the first place, this is not an inquisitorial court here to try brethren. What we are here to do is to discuss issues, not personalities. And I would be no party to getting up here and reading off a list of names. Now, if it comes to an article or a book, or something of that type, as he has suggested, that you have the evidence, well and good. I tell you what, you couldn't put your finger on a lot of these fellows anyway. They use what I call weasel words. A good brother can read an article and see nothing wrong in it, and someone that's acquainted with the lingo can see in every word a suggestion of the trend that he's taking in the matter of liberal advancement. And so I just don't think that this is the time or place, and I have never been a party to it, and I never will. From this platform, it's not the place of Freed Hardeman College or this forum to try brethren in the sense of determining whether they're loyal or not. Now, there's not any difficulty in ascertaining who these fellows are. And so why is it that some in the group want us to just call names up here? That is not the purpose of this, and while I have, as all of you know, I've been engaged in controversy all of my life, but I still see that the chief purpose of this forum is to discuss issues, not to try personalities. Do you agree with that, brethren?
Amen.
All right. Now, anything further on the points that we've thus far raised?
I'd like to say,
yes, Brother Nicholas.
Come
up here to the stand.
Those who have read the restoration literature are familiar with the fact that a man may get into serious trouble when he begins to call names when he doesn't have the proof at hand. We know about how that Alexander Campbell got into prison and stayed in prison for a long time, and he never did get over it. He died a man of a broken heart and lost health as a result of staying in prison, had pneumonia there, all because he called the name of a man. There are two men with the same name, but anyway, it involved him in a slander suit. And we know the danger, therefore. Any man can sue you for slander, and it puts you to a lot of trouble and a lot of expense to try to prove his guilt if you don't have the evidence at hand. Now, another thing, the very people upon whom you depend as witnesses may forsake you when you need them. They'll leave you in trouble, and you can't prove your statement. And so it's a good idea to shield yourself to some extent and be careful. I think that warning might save some lawsuits and slander suits here and there in view of that. Now, Paul called some names. He said, Alexander the coppersmith did me much evil. And then he didn't curse him out, but he said the Lord reward him according to his works. And the criticism of a man who feels that way about us would not make us want to sue him likely. Let us exercise the right attitude and spirit. Another thing, if it's a personal matter, settle it with a man, or try to settle it without embarrassing him. There's a rule called the golden rule that we must not forget. How would we like to be treated if we were in error and people begin to advertise us in the papers? Now, I've had statements published about me that were terribly false. Such, for instance, as that I said one time in an article or a sermon outline that it would be a sin to use a large table that had a marble top on it. Well, I never believed that a minute in my life, never said anything of the sort. And a man wrote me up in the Gospel Guardian from our very county, said I said that, and then said that we had turned right around and put more than $3,000 worth of marble in our church building, so as to create prejudice against me like that. Well, I've not answered it publicly. I didn't think it would do any good. I had an opportunity to teach the man otherwise. Let's not forget that golden rule. And let's not forget that many times people will forsake you when you need them in court. They'll even leave the country temporarily to keep from appearing there. Maybe they've lied to you about it. They don't want to face the facts. And you need to be protected.
Yes, I endorse that statement 100%. I think that Brother Nichols would agree, as all of us would, that when men are on record in publications, then it's entirely in order to use their terms, whether it be in a tract, in a book, in an article. I do not hesitate then, as all of you who have been reading from me for a quarter of a century know, that I've often dealt by name, in fact always by name when it was necessary. But I just don't think that this is the time or place to get up here and start that, because there's no need of it. In the first place, it's easy to ascertain who men are who are being questioned. And this is not, as I say, a court to try and condemn. Certainly unheard. Now, you remember last year, we were confronted here with brethren who felt that they were being misrepresented. We tried to deal with them as fairly as we could and to the extent that we felt that the occasion justified. And we'd do it again and again. We'll never refrain, so long as I have anything to do with this forum, we will allow anybody to be heard on any proper subject. Yes, sir.
I'd like to say right there that it might be a good thing also, if you want to know what somebody thinks, ask them rather than start asking all the other people around.
Amen.
Another thing, we have brethren that oftentimes toy with dangerous ideas. I know a fellow, and he's certainly not involved in any of the current controversies, but a good many years ago, he wrote an article for one of the magazines that was largely a trial balloon affair. It was an example of very, very poor judgment. He wasn't committed fully to the view. He just wanted to see what would be the reaction. Well, the reaction was that the brethren pounced on him, and for years, there was a question mark with reference to his loyalty. It was a piece of poor judgment. Another thing happens, that sometimes brethren will toy with these things and then back off from them if they can do so by saving face. I found this out, brethren, in dealing with the Annie question. If you could get to a fellow before he ever made one public speech on the subject, or before he ever wrote anything on it, you had a good opportunity to do something with him. But if he ever had made a public statement, or had written anything on it, it was nearly impossible to do anything with it.
Amen.
Because there's a lot to this matter of saving face. Few people are willing to say that I am wrong. I recognize my error and I want to correct it. Few people will do
it. Say I'm wrong again.
Yes, sir. That's right. That's right. And so for that reason, I think that we need to use good judgment on these matters. Is it all right to partake of the Lord's Supper on Thursday night as Jesus did? Now, bear in mind that the institution of the supper was, as a matter of fact, it was in connection with the observance of the Passover feast. And it is not an example of the observance of the supper in the church. The only time the Lord ever observed the supper in the church was on the first day of the week, because he said to the disciples, I'll not eat with you again until the kingdom comes. Well, when he ate with them the next time, the kingdom had come, and that was on the Lord's day. And the only time the Lord ever observed the supper in the church was on the first day of the week. And the only example that we have of the church observing the Lord's Supper is on the first day of the week. Acts 20:7, the disciples came together on the first day of the week to break bread, unless you prefer the so-called Good News translation, which says they came together on Saturday night for a fellowship meal, which of course strikes out of the New Testament the only passage that establishes the observance of the supper specifically on the first day of the week. Now, you can prove that the church met on the first day of the week without Acts 20 and 7. You can prove that at some time or other they observed the Lord's Supper. But it takes Acts 20 and 7 to show that they did it on the first day of the week. And that so-called translation strikes it out, which is not a translation. It is simply a liberal commentary on the text. Has many objections to it. Anybody anything on that point? Yes, sir. Two of you. First you.
Would you set forth the views that are held by people that